SEC fans, welcome to the Saturday Down South podcast. Coming to you from the iHeartMedia studio, WDAE in Tampa, Florida, 620 AM and 95.3 FM. My name is John Crist, senior writer for Saturday Down South. His name is Connor O'Gara, national columnist for Saturday Down South. You can follow me on Twitter at SaturdayJC. You can follow him at CJ O'Gara. Connor, as kind of tends to be the case in this conference, you'll learn very quickly. There's been a lot of news this week, and most of it tends to revolve around Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Yeah, go figure. Number one team in the country, gets a little bit of press in the preseason, not necessarily for being the number one team in the country, but just for everything else that's going on. Pretty fitting.
No such thing as a little bit of press for the Crimson Tide. But before we get into that, my guy, the Saturday Down South podcast is brought to you by our friends at Ticket City. College football is quickly approaching with some fantastic matchups on the horizon. Alabama, Florida State, Michigan, Florida, Georgia, Notre Dame. Now's the time to get your tickets if you haven't already. We've been working with Ticket City for a long time. They're the experts in this field. 1.5 million customers served at this point. They're the place to go if you want to go to some of these big ticket games. 30 years now, they're the guys. They're also offering a discount for all of our podcast listeners. All you need to do is go to TicketCity.com, enter the discount code SDS20 at checkout, and you're going to get $20 off the game of your choice. Again, that's TicketCity.com, discount code SDS20. So let's get started on the Alabama stuff. First, there's a lot of Alabama stuff to talk about, but initially, this quarterback story that popped up at ESPN.com just the other day, very interesting. You know, Blake Barnett and Cooper Bateman and also David Cornwell as well, all three of these young men transferred out of the Crimson Tide after Jalen Hurts exploded onto the scene and became ultimately the offensive player of the year in the SEC as a true freshman. But Barnett and Bateman in particular were hunted down by a reporter from ESPN. They did not have super kind things to say about Coach Saban. They spread no ill will to their former players, but they felt a little bit duped. And I believe Barnett is now at Arizona State and Bateman is at Utah. And Bateman's not even playing quarterback anymore. Barnett has a chance to be the starter. But it sounds like there's some mixed emotions and some miscommunication with Coach Saban. What's sort of your take on this when this story broke?
Well, it's easy to make it seem like they have sour grapes, because in their position, anything that they say kind of looks catty because they're the guys that ultimately didn't win the starting quarterback job and transferred from Alabama. And you're basically trying to say Nick Saban did something wrong, which in today's age, that's an increasingly difficult thing to do. So from their perspective, it doesn't necessarily look great the way that you come across and say, oh yeah, well, you know, he didn't communicate with us. He didn't let us know that this was how it was going to be. We thought that we were going to be getting a lot more playing time. The USC game happens, and then it just kind of all falls apart, and then they realize quickly we don't have a place here. So, I mean, I get that they have sour grapes, but at the same time, you're Nick Saban. You're trying to win national championships. You're not worried about hurt feelings. So I can kind of understand where both sides stand on this, and it's just interesting that it comes out now, I guess.
Well, that's when the phone call was made. If you sort of follow what's been happening in the Twitter sphere, you know, Barnett has been attacked a little bit by Alabama fans and the like, and so was Bateman. And a couple of current players in Tuscaloosa came to their defense and said, look, nobody should be throwing these young men under the bus. You know, I mean, once Bama, always Bama. But I want to sort of dissect one of the things you said in your first comment about not winning a starting job. Technically, Blake Barnett did win the starting job. He actually started the season opener this past September against USC, and he was told he was going to be the guy, and Bateman was told he was going to be a part of the game plan as well. But two series into the game, Barnett gets yanked. It's not Bateman that comes in. It's Jalen Hurts that comes in, and the rest is history. So I can see the perspective of these two young men probably being told one thing in a meeting room, but in the coach's office, clearly there was another plan going on there. And I really don't know how honest Coach Saban was with these two guys, and I don't know how honest he needs to be. I could argue both sides of this till I'm blue in the face.
It's interesting, because if I went back and looked at the series, because if you recall, Alabama actually didn't take off with Hurts immediately. It wasn't like Hurts
not at all.
And then set the offense ablaze, and it was like, okay, he led this dominant blowout attack. He actually only, I think he got four series as opposed to, you know, what Bateman got, which was two series and then ultimately pulled. And Hurts actually fumbled on his very first play, and Saban kept him in there, and he kept him in there, and it wasn't a zone option type deal that he was leaving him in there for, just this kind of a change of pace thing. He gave him a legitimate chance. He gave him series after series to lead drives. So I think you're correct in that, you know, Hurts wasn't the starter for day one, obviously, but ultimately he ends up winning the job out, and they saw the writing on the wall. So, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, the opening game against USC wasn't going to dictate the rest of the season necessarily, but when something like that happens, it's inevitable. So I get the frustration from their standpoint. I come back to, he's Nick Saban. His communication isn't always going to be 100%. He tells a lot of people certain things, and that's just kind of the nature of the business. He's dealing with kids that were five-star recruits that have been handed every opportunity and more to succeed, and for these guys specifically, this is the first time maybe in their careers that they haven't, you know, been rock stars and, you know, been given kind of the keys to the car. So I understand this whole situation, this whole dynamic. It's awkward. I mean, that's what this is from all standpoints. It's just awkward.
Yeah, I pulled up the drive chart myself, and Barnett starts the game four plays and out with a punt on the first drive, three plays and out with a punt on the second drive. They make the switch to Hurts. Okay, you want to do a couple series at a time, but if anything, Hurts got a longer rope. It, like you said, his very first collegiate snap, he fumbled, turnover, USC gets the ball. His second series, he goes back out there, it's a punt. His third series, he goes back out there, another punt. Only on his fourth series, I believe after a turnover where the Crimson Tide got the ball deep in Trojan territory, I believe at about the 35-yard line, then he put it in the end zone, and it was just arithmetic after that. He scores a touchdown on that drive, which was his fourth, a field goal after that. Then it was halftime, but coming out in the third quarter, touchdown on his first drive, touchdown on his second drive, on his fourth drive, another touchdown, on his fifth drive, another touchdown, and on the sixth, another touchdown. By the time we got there, of course, it was a blowout and the disparity was known. But again, it's a little dicey there because Blake Barnett, let's not forget, he was the number one quarterback recruit in the country. He had more hype coming into Tuscaloosa than Jalen Hurts did, who was, yeah, he was highly rated, but he was a four-star kid. So it's a very funky situation, and it's just become, I think this is only news because somebody at ESPN picked up the phone. These young men answered the question. That was all there is to it. I don't think there was any malice on the part of the two quarterbacks who left, but yeah, nobody really looks good in this. Bateman looks a little sour grape. So does Cooper Bateman. I'm sorry, so does Barnett. And this is more Nick Saban just, it's all about the program. It's all about how I can win games. And the fallout is what the fallout is. And everyone will forgive him because of how many butts he puts in the seats and how many wins he puts in the column on the left.
It's interesting, too, because Saban has been, he's changed his approach to coaching, he said, in that he doesn't tell players, he doesn't try and motivate players by saying, you need to be all about the team. He says, you need to be about yourselves, because if you invest in yourselves, that's ultimately going to make the team better. So, of course, you know, this whole Barnett thing happens, and Saban says publicly, basically throws him under the bus and said that it's a selfish choice, and he basically goes after a 20-year-old who's looking out for his best interests and who wants to maybe make it to the NFL one day. And so it's a little bit of hypocrisy, and I can understand why there's people who would be frustrated from that, but it's Nick Saban. He's got a job to do. He's got other more important things to worry about than his backup quarterback's feelings. And, you know, he's going to do what he wants to do. That's what we've learned, and we'll come to expect the same thing year in, year out.
Yeah, and there's going to be a little bit of an effect on Alabama this season. Like we said last year, they had four quarterbacks, all pretty highly rated scholarship kids on this depth chart. It was Hurts and then Bateman and then Cooper. I keep saying Barnett and Bateman. The names are too funky to me. But they also had David Cornwell, who played a little bit earlier in his career. And the other three guys are gone. At the top of the depth chart right now is Hurts. Again, fantastic, incredible, one of the best true freshman seasons in SEC history for a quarterback. But right behind him is another true freshman right now, Tua Tagovailoa. The kid from Hawaii is number two on the depth chart. He got a lot of action in that spring game. Yes, he looks very advanced for such a young age, but I know Alabama's loaded on both sides of the ball, and of course you feel good about the development of Hurts, but you had three potential veteran backup quarterbacks who are no longer there, and I actually wrote this during the offseason. Having an experienced backup quarterback that you can feel good about, it is going the way of the dodo bird. With the way these young men transfer out when they don't get what they want, having a reliable backup, it just seems like a thing of the past at this point, and Nick Saban is not going to have one this fall.
Yeah, and I can't blame him for necessarily being frustrated with the situation of not having this bevy of quarterbacks that he thought he had and be able to pick and choose and just knowing that, okay, if somebody goes down, we're going to be all right. I mean, you need to have a quarterback to win. Even if you're Alabama, you've got to have somebody that can at least make the right decisions. I understand it's all about the defense, all about the running game, it's all about winning the battle in the trenches. You still have to have a quarterback, and there were still big moments last year where we saw that with Jalen Hurts, where they said, hey, we need you to go make a play for us. We need you to come up clutch, and he did. And, you know, whether or not Alabama has the right guy in place if something were to happen to Hurts, I guess only time will tell. But it's interesting that, you know, if that happens, how many people are going to look around the country and look at this situation that's been developing with former Alabama quarterbacks and think, wow, what if Saban had just gone about this a little bit differently? What if he had just tried to communicate and kind of saw their side of this whole thing? Would that have made a difference? I don't know, but there's going to be a lot of people speculating, that's for sure.
Well, in Saban's defense, look, he had an open competition the previous spring. Hurts was an early enrollee out of high school from the Texas area. So there was no real need and no real motivation for Saban to announce his starter. He had USC in week one. I know it ended up being a blowout. 52-6 was the final, but it's USC. They weren't playing Middle Tennessee State or something like that. And we'll probably see that with schools like Florida and Tennessee this year when they have these open competitions. There's no motivation to announce who your starter is going to be because, of course, that helps from a game planning perspective on the other side. But just imagine if Hurts was as good as the reports were as an early enrollee freshman, and he was the best they had, even though he hadn't even gone to his senior prom yet, Saban can't announce him as the starter. Because if he does, Barnett's going to go, and Bateman's going to go, and Comwell's going to go before you even get to fall camp. And then he's in a much worse situation in the fall. He's got Hurts and nobody else. So it kind of feels weird siding with Coach Saban when he gets snippy about these things. But from that perspective, you can certainly see why he did it the way he did it.
Totally understand. It's kind of a no-win situation. Saban feels like he didn't get what he wants. You know, these guys left other schools seeking what they wanted at Alabama. And ultimately, this just comes back to hurt feelings and the college football world as we know it.
You know, there's one more comment I want to make on this before we move on, and that's about Blake Barnett in particular. I know that right now everything looks fine. You know, he left the program about a year ago, but I don't like the way he went about it initially. Yes, he lost the job. Yes, he was only going to get garbage time reps the rest of the year. Hurts became a star very quickly. He's going to be one of the faces of college football this year for all the right reasons. But I did not like the fact that he just walked away from that program a couple weeks into the season. That didn't make a lot of sense to me. He was a rolled ankle away from getting back out there. By the way, he has five-star tools himself. Who's to say that he couldn't have ignited that offense as well? I didn't like how he basically quit on his team and left. I know that it was the best for him in the long run. I know he has a chance to play right away because he petitioned the NCAA, and basically they count last year as his transfer year sitting out. They're okay with that. So I understand in the long run it was best for him. But quitting on your team a couple weeks into the season, I'll never be okay with that. I'll never be okay with that. We saw it with Jalen Hurd, the running back from Tennessee last year. There's no way not to color that incredibly selfish, and I think that's a black mark on Mr. Barnett. Hopefully he'll move past it. He's a 20-year-old kid, and you understand, but at least finish the season and then think about your future.
And I hate to say it, but we're only going to see more decisions like that in the future. I can't help but think we'll probably see more this year at big-time programs, guys that just pick up and leave and decide, you know what, I don't have a place here. I don't feel like my road to the NFL is getting any clearer with my current role at this place, and I need to find somewhere where that can happen. And, you know, the team concept is kind of lost, but that's just reality, and I think it's going to become, unfortunately, it's going to become more and more common.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it quite like that just yet, but I think you're exactly right, because originally, I think Bateman left after about 3 weeks into the season. He was going to have to sit out a month or so at his new destination, but again, he and his family petitioned the NCAA, and they wiped the slate clean. He's going to be able to play week one if he wins that job, so yeah, it's a tangled web, and yeah, I think that's going to be one of those things where it's going to be very difficult to get that horse back in the barn. Let's keep the conversation Crimson Tide related. Granted, it comes about 2,500 miles away from Los Angeles, but Josh Rosen has sort of been the topic of conversation in college football the last 24 hours or so. Matt Hayes from Bleacher Report ran a very, very insightful Q&A. I know Matt a little bit. I've spent some time around him at events like the SEC Media Days. He's very good at what he does. He has sort of a specific tactic he goes about things. He's a story finder, and he just found a very good one. But Alabama sort of got in the crosshairs here. You wrote something about it. I agree 100%. When you parse up every single comment this young man made, it's easy to say he took a shot at Alabama. If you actually take 10 minutes and read the interview start to finish, he was just making an example. But this is 21st century journalism. This is aggregation gone bad. We're making Rosen out to be a bad kid taking pot shots at Alabama. I certainly didn't see it that way. You wrote about it, and I know you didn't either.
Yeah, I didn't see this as something where he was saying academically speaking, Alabama is dumb or the football team is dumb. Essentially what he was saying is that at a program like Alabama, if you raise the SAT standards, or, you know, Alabama was used as the example because Alabama is the standard in college football. I think that's what we can all agree on that. Even Urban Meyer came out and said that, essentially. So if you have a program like Alabama that all of a sudden decides we're going to raise SAT standards because we want to make sure that our kids are academically prepared to handle the rigors of college in addition to playing big-time college football. Well, you're eliminating a lot of kids by doing that. But if you have the way the current model is set up to allow these kids to get into the school, doesn't mean that they can necessarily handle what Rosen called having two full-time jobs, that is, being a student-athlete, playing college football. You can debate whether or not Rosen's points were accurate, but his opinions were what you believe. That's, you know, totally your call, but his point wasn't that Alabama just has dumb football players. His point was nothing like that at all. But of course, you take that little clip and you put it as a headline, and all of a sudden, SportsCenter runs with it. All of a sudden, the Big Lead runs with it, and Alabama fans are upset. And it's attacking Josh Rosen, and it's attacking a kid who was talking about a very real issue in this day and age of college athletics. And, you know, he got into some bigger picture things that most people don't touch. You know, credit a kid for actually doing his homework on something and coming up with an opinion on it. I don't think his point was to call out Alabama. I actually thought, if anything, Clemson might have had the most sour grapes. He had a comment about Clemson that would, you know, could have been taken one way or another, but it definitely wasn't a shot at Alabama. I think this is just a kid who is speaking his mind about something he's very passionate about and something he's very close to, and maybe even too close to the situation given where he's at right now.
So what did you think about the several points that he was making? Like you said, a lot of big picture things. I think that this is a conversation that we need to have. I don't know if he's the right messenger. Now, Rosen has been a lightning rod in the past. Even going back to his freshman year, he's just not afraid to talk. And he'll say a lot of things on his mind. Clearly, he has big goals for his life, not only on the gridiron, but off. And you commend him for that. He's trying to get the most out of his education in addition to his athletic career. That's perfectly fine. But I read something on Twitter. It was Bomani Jones, I believe. I'm usually not a huge fan of his necessarily, but he did make a very good point on Twitter that if you are Josh Rosen, meaning a silver spoon in your mouth, gated community type of California kid, and you make a comment like this, that football and school don't mix, it's too much on one person to do, he sounds like a spoiled brat. He sounds like a spoiled brat. That's the only way to color it. But if it's someone from the inner city, if it's a kid who comes from very meager background, then the cry is, you should just appreciate what you have, young man. We're giving you free clothes and free food and a chance to play football, and maybe you'll go to the NFL and you'd be back in the hood if it wasn't for college football. It's very difficult for a college player, 19, 20 years old, to take sort of an activist role. So it's real easy to tear it down and say, look, you're just a kid. You don't know what you're talking about. That's in a long extrapolated way of me to ask you, what did you think about his platform in general?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because Cardale Jones, of course, is kind of the the comparison. I mean, he didn't say it quite the same way that Rosen did. And interestingly enough, Cardale Jones goes on Twitter and says, just play school, man. I thought that was hilarious, no matter what you think about the whole subject. The irony of him being able to go back now as a graduate of Ohio State, looking back on his tweets and coming up with that opinion is pretty ironic in itself. But you're right in that the platform matters, and coming from a kid who is currently in college, as adults who are out of college, and for former college athletes, you know, naturally they're not going to side with him because they've been through it. They handled two full-time jobs and they were better for it. So it's hard to, for a lot of people, it's hard to feel sympathy for college athletes and college football players in particular that are getting full ride scholarships when A, their academic standards aren't what they need to be, and B, you know, they're getting an opportunity to still get an education and potentially make millions of dollars in the NFL. So I get that there are people that are frustrated with this stance. Perspective and platform is such a key element here, and I think it kind of dictates where you stand on this whole thing. It's kind of hard to see somebody else's viewpoint when you obviously only went through college once and you experienced your way of college. Rosen's way of college is a very, very small group of people, and I think he was trying to speak on behalf of the greater good of college football and trying to speak on behalf of a bunch of his teammates. The problem is the platform and where he's saying it. This is the kid who had an inflatable hot tub in his dorm room as a freshman, has been very outspoken about the NCAA. So take that with a grain of salt. Unfortunately, it goes into the equation, and instead we're examining where the comment came from instead of the actual comment itself.
Yeah, it's like Rosen has sort of appointed himself the head of the College Football Players Union, even though it doesn't exist, and he feels like he's the guy who has the mouthpiece and he's going to put these things out there. I don't think he's speaking for all of college football. I agree with some of the things he had to say. I vehemently disagree with a couple things, particularly the comment about having two full-time jobs. I don't think that's the case. You know, practice during football season, it's 20 hours a week. It's mandated by the NCAA. Of course, he has to be in the weight room. He has to be in the film room. There's meetings and there's this and there's travel and there's that. I understand it's a lot more than 20 hours, but for a kid carrying 12 or 15 hours a week at a school, whether it's Stanford, whether it's East Nowhere State, I don't consider that a full-time job. I have a college degree. It took me 4 years. Trust me, I screwed around as much as anybody listening to this show, and I got out of school and I did just fine. Now, this isn't about me, but I think that this starts sort of comes from a guy who he probably hasn't worked a whole lot of full-time jobs in his life, obviously. He doesn't appreciate what it truly takes to be a blue-collar type and put food on the table. And the 40-hour work week in America is basically gone, by the way. 50 or 60 tends to be pretty standard. So I just disagree with his idea that you can't do both. Sure, there are some kids that are on his team that shouldn't be there. They're not qualified. They don't have the background or the acumen to handle an education at a place like UCLA. But they want to win football games, and they let him in that school. So, and another comment is, if a college football player can't do both, then nobody can, because it doesn't matter if you're the star quarterback like Josh Rosen or you're a walk-on fullback that is never going to get a snap that matters. You have access to more than any other student on campus could dream of, whether it's study halls or it's going to be access to tutors and making sure you get to register first, you get the proper schedule. These guys have everything humanly possible to make sure they get through school. So, again, I could argue the other side. Yes, kids are just, they keep them eligible. They're not worried about their actual degrees. But don't tell me you can't be a student. Don't tell me you can't be a college football player. And they're mutually exclusive. I know I'm a Florida State guy and I bring it up a lot, but Christian Ponder was at Florida State for 5 years because he redshirted and played for four. He, by the time he got out of there, A, he was a first-round pick to the Minnesota Vikings, and B, he had his MBA, not just his undergraduate degree, an MBA. It can be done. It takes a special human being. I think Josh Rosen is a special human being, which is one of the reasons why I feel like he's complaining about something when he's in as good a shape as anybody in this situation.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider, too, that he isn't necessarily, he's not, you know, somebody who's struggling and he's saying, I can't handle two full-time jobs. He's saying there are a lot of people who do, and he's saying that we need to put more things in place to help out these student-athletes. Now, there's always more that can be done. That's obviously, we can be doing more to help out these kids that are getting in with low SAT scores that would not be getting in if not for a football scholarship. Having said that, you brought it up earlier, all the tutors, all the early registration for classes, they get to take summer school. They get so many opportunities that normal students don't. How much more help can you really give a kid who is getting a full ride scholarship at that school? That's kind of where I had trouble with, is he's making out to seem like they're just accepted into a university and then they're just kind of like hung out to dry. I don't agree with that at all. I think I've seen college athletes that have, you know, they have joke majors and they don't have to take this credit hour and they don't have to take that, and they get into whatever, you know, class they want. And so I have a tough time really empathizing with that point of, we need to help these kids out more when they get in there because the demands are too rigorous. I think the system is set up well for a college kid to succeed now compared to what it was then. I think that you have great opportunities, people that are going to go out of their way to help you. I just don't really see that whole logic there in terms of complaining about not being able to handle the academic rigors. You should be able to handle the academic rigors of college. Should everybody be in college? I mean, I guess not necessarily, and he made a point to that too, and that you should just sort of be able to major in football, but it's still amateur athletics. It's for as much money that goes into this whole thing with the TV contracts and all that stuff, it's amateur athletics, and we forget that at times, but it's not amateur athletics if all of a sudden that just goes out the window, kids are majoring in football. I think that maybe in a few years he's going to have a different viewpoint, and he made some interesting points, but I think that for the most part, a lot of what he said is because he's so wrapped up in it, and that's the way he's seeing life. And I think that just in a little bit of time, he's going to realize, you know, as you mentioned, the workforce is a whole lot different than being an academic student in college. I think we can both attest to that as you know, guys who graduated from four-year universities that have seen what the workforce is like and how much you have to grind in that as well. So I don't know. People are going to debate it until the cows come home. I guess that's what we're sort of doing now. But, you know, people are going to continue to talk about this as he remains a prospect and somebody that draft scouts are going to look at. And goodness gracious, if you think this topic is going away, it's not.
It never goes away.
More and more potent as he becomes, you know, one of these top draft prospects.
Yeah, I've covered the NFL long enough to know that this is never going away, that this stuff does not escape your draft profile, whether you realize it or not. And I will give him some rope. He's 20 years old. He's young. He's blonde. He's good-looking. He's California. And he probably thinks he owns the world, and maybe one day he will. And it's just a plague of society. I know I had it. I bet you had the same affliction. You're 20 years old. You think you got it by the balls, and you know everything. And eventually you're 30, you're 40, you're 50, and you realize what a schmuck you were when you're 20. And that's not a shot at Josh Rosen. That's just the way we're wired as human beings. But I do find this a little bit insulting when he basically insinuates, he didn't say it, but he's insinuating that the only people on campus at UCLA, or again, middle nowhere state, that they're the only ones working hard. like every other kid who's a full-time student is just hanging out at the bar every night and going to the fraternity house during the day and taking naps and sleeping until 2 p.m. and just taking a couple of blow-off classes and having your 2.5 average. And, oh, 4 years goes by. Sure, I got a big hangover, but here's your diploma, young man. There are plenty of people of school, more than aren't, plenty of people in school that work full-time jobs, that have to take care of families because they're older students. And you know what? They're floating the boat for the whole thing. They're taking out hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of loans, hoping to be a lawyer one day so they can pay those back and be a contributing member of society. It's not just football that's difficult, Josh. It's not just football. There's plenty of kids on campus you probably pass and don't notice on a daily basis who get just as little sleep as you do, who work just as hard as you do. No one shows up and fills a stadium full of 75,000 people to do it. But don't tell me the football players are the only ones that have it tough on a college campus.
Yeah, my student loans can speak to that. Oh, I appreciate also you saying that we were schmucks and that we are no longer schmucks. That's a nice distinction there.
Up for debate.
I probably would have just assumed, yes, I'm definitely still a schmuck. And I'm a schmuck who is paying off student loans, and as are millions of people across the country. College football players will not have to do that. That's a different discussion, but you're right. And, you know, there are benefits that maybe go a little bit unnoticed. Are too many people making too much money off of them? Yes, but this is the system that's in place. It's not perfect. That's just reality. Life's not perfect. The system's not perfect. And I think we can just agree to disagree all we want on certain things in terms of, you know, the journalist perspective as opposed to the college athlete perspective. But, you know, I don't see anything changing anytime soon in that regard. But I guess credit the kid for advocating for something he believes in, right?
No, I'm not going to sit here and champion the NCAA's cause, and it is a perfect system. Obviously it isn't. There's problems left and right, and some we know and some we still don't know. They're going to pop up down the road. But this is a system that's in place. As Hyman Roth said in Godfather 2, this is the business we've chosen. There's no other route. If you want to go to the NFL and be one of those guys on Sunday, you have to play high school football and then go play 3 years of college football, and then you're eligible to do it. This isn't the NBA. This isn't Major League Baseball. It's a different system for baseball in particular. You could be crazy talented, sign right out of high school, go to the minors, develop your game there, and then go to the big leagues. The NBA, you only need to be out of high school 1 year. You can go overseas and play. There's a developmental league. They're calling that the Gatorade League now, I believe. But the path is a little quicker. Football doesn't offer that. There is no minor league football. There is no way for a 19-year-old kid who doesn't want to invest in the rigors of an education to develop himself and get ready for the NFL. That is just the system they have in place. And if Josh wants to make $100 million as an NFL quarterback one day, this is the route. This is the price of admission. It's not perfect, but compared to a lot of other kids on campus, I don't think it's a stretch to say it's pretty damn good.
Life could be a lot worse for Josh Rosen. I think we can all agree on that.
We can definitely all agree on that. Let's leave that topic there. One more thing before we get out of here. The coaching hot seat, of course, Connor, is something that we write about and talk about ad nauseum in the offseason, but I want to sort of compare and contrast how that conversation is going in a place like College Station, Texas versus Knoxville, Tennessee. You know, one of the big offseason topics was in June at the SEC spring meetings in Destin, Florida, where Scott Woodward, the athletic director for A&M, basically put his own coach, Kevin Sumlin, squarely on the hot seat, said he has to do better. He's been 8-5 3 years in a row. That tells me if Sumlin doesn't win 9 games, he's probably out of a job. So, hottest seat in the SEC, I don't think there's a question it belongs to Sumlin. But in Knoxville, things are a little different. I think that people outside of that community want to put Butch Jones on the hot seat, A, because he's kind of a punching bag with some of the goofy things he's said that have been just, people have so much fun with it on social media and the like with the 5-star hearts and all things like that. But it seems like his athletic director, John Curry, is going out of his way to take his coach off the hot seat. People think that maybe Jones is in trouble for coming up short last year and not winning the East when he had the club to do so. And basically, the university is rallying around him. not only is it John Curry, but it's Philip Fulmer, the former coach who now works in an advisory role to the president. So the compare and contrast between those two programs is obviously 180 degrees different. It seems like Tennessee is really trying to get that out there, that Coach Jones is safe. I don't know what the conversations are like behind closed doors, but they're being very public supporting their coach.
I think, as they should. In my opinion, the situation in College Station is significantly different. You have a guy in Kevin Sumlin who people talk about plateauing as a coach. That's such a scary thing for a fan base. Once a fan base believes you've plateaued, you're essentially toast and your days are numbered. I don't think that it's fair to even call it really a plateau because he started with that 11-win season. And maybe the problem with Sumlin is that expectations were set so high with Johnny Football and you beat Alabama and you do all these great things in the division. And then after that, you haven't finished better than fourth in the West. That's not good. I mean, there are stats about Sumlin that are just bad, like really bad. I mean, 4-4 against Power 5 teams after October 11th in the last 3 years. 4-14 against Power 5 teams. That's not just an Alabama problem. That's an everyone problem. Against LSU and Alabama, he's 1-9. And the one win was that Johnny Manziel going off, playing out of his mind, playing essentially the game of his life. So there, you look at stats like that and the fact that he is, you know, 3 straight 8-win seasons, and you're like, man, how can this guy not be on the hot seat? He absolutely is, in my opinion. And he is what we call a no-excuse job. The guy's making $5 million at a place that has a great recruiting ground. He has a chance to win year in, year out with those resources, with that venue. I just don't see this as a job that you can accept 8 wins. It's a steady 9-10 win program that needs to at least be competing for division titles. And that's been the problem with Sumlin, is that he's been so bad in the second half of seasons that his fans aren't even, like, locked into a conference title race. They're so good early in the year, and they beat up on all these teams, and they get expectations so high, and then they just fall off the face of the earth. And it's interesting because Butch Jones is kind of the inverse of that. He wins these bowl games, and all of a sudden it's great optimism in the off season, and then quickly we realize in the season that maybe we were a little too high on Tennessee, and then everybody kind of comes back down to earth. So it's interesting how much perspective has dictated the public – well, just sort of the national opinion of those two coaches, because I do agree. I think they're in different situations right now, and what their ADs have come out and said have been indicative of that.
Yeah, I wrote on Monday in our Crystal Ball series running at Saturday down south. Texas A&M was on Monday, last in the SEC West. But Sumlin, I think I wrote it in 2012, his first year, he sort of under-promised and over-delivered. I don't know if that was by design, but Johnny Manziel fell in his lap, and he set the world afire and won the Heisman Trophy, and he wasn't even really the favorite to win the starting job before he eventually got out there and just set the world afire. So maybe there was a little bit of luck there, and he's been trying to recreate that ever since. Clearly, he caught the rest of the SEC off guard that first year in the league. They didn't know what to expect from that coach, from that player, from that offense. And they were very exciting and a lot of fun, and they belonged in the best conference in America right away. But since then, there's lots of other ugly stats for Coach Sumlin. The month of November, the last 4 years, he's 7-9. And this is incredible to me. In 2014, 2015, and 2016, each of the last 3 seasons, Texas A&M has been ranked in the top 10 and then out of the rankings altogether because they just completely fall apart. I know there's excuses from a year ago. It was never the same after Trevor Knight banged up his shoulder. Myles Garrett, the generational pass rusher, was never 100%. But this is a team that has, the peaks are incredibly high, but the valleys are crazy low. And yeah, there's no question he's on the hottest seat in the SEC, and rightfully so.
Yeah, Butch Jones in that third season, I always say the third season is so telling for a head coach, because that's when your recruits come in. You're not playing with somebody else, with the previous coaches, players. And I think that's just maybe the best indicator of how a coach is going to be long-term. And Butch Jones won 9 games in his third season. That was a program that he inherited that won 5 games and wasn't very good. It wasn't Tennessee football. It wasn't a blue blood program. And he made them relevant. And Tennessee, at least last year, was still relevant. You can debate whether or not they got lucky at certain points of the season, and you know, whether or not they were really as bad as they were by the end of the season because of injuries or because it's Butch Jones as a coach. But Tennessee was relevant, and Tennessee remained relevant for most of the season. I know that they had their fair share of ups and downs at the end, but this is a guy who has still been able to recruit at a high level, is winning, and you know, that wasn't always a given at Tennessee. And I think Butch Jones gets so much flack because of the Champions of Life stuff, and the things that he says are just kind of robotic and out there, and you're just kind of like, what in the world is he's almost developed a little bit of a Les Miles like kind of persona, but Les Miles a little bit happy-go-lucky about it. And he's just tough to put your finger on, because you're like, all right, if you're really this great coach, you'll win an East title in a year that you're not supposed to, or you'll win in a year where you're supposed to, like last year. But we just kind of can't figure him out. And I think that's why nationally we're just a little bit confused, because we see this guy that's kind of downplaying Tennessee's failures a bit and with the Champions of Life stuff. So what he does this year, now if he wins four games, then yeah, of course we're talking about a guy who could be out of a job. But I think this is one of those years where if he wins 8-9 games, I don't think we're having this conversation in a few months.
No, I don't think so either. And I think something catastrophic would have to happen for him to lose his job because of what he's done, because the image he projects, and clearly the university has backed him at every corner publicly. Again, we don't know what's happening behind closed doors on Rocky Top, but the AD has been vocal and Coach Fulmer has been vocal. But, you know, you look at the end product last season. Yes, they won 9 games and they win their third consecutive bowl game. But are they winning the right 9 games? Yes, it was 9-4. But you lose to Vanderbilt, your in-state rival, which shouldn't be a rivalry at all. And then you lose to South Carolina coming off a bye. I know that the Gamecocks sort of surprised last year, but they shouldn't have beaten that Tennessee team. You play Texas A&M, and yes, I know you had the incredible finish against Florida. You finally break through there. You have the Hail Mary against Georgia a week after that. Sure, you're just out of gas, some 5-hour double overtime marathon in College Station. I can forgive you that one. But that was the roster that was supposed to be able to compete with Alabama. You get the Tide in front of 100-plus thousand at Neyland Stadium, and you get blown out of the building. It wasn't competitive after the opening kickoff. And I know you've won 3 games in a row in the postseason in bowl games, Coach Jones, but I know you're a Big Ten guy at heart, Connor, but you beat Iowa, you beat Northwestern, and you beat Nebraska. And I don't think you should be celebrating beating some Big Ten also-rans in late December bowl games that nobody nationally is truly paying attention to. I think the bar should be higher at Tennessee. I don't think he's on the hot seat, but if he slips back to 7-5 this year, I think it could be scorching in 2018.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think this is a place that should necessarily accept 8-9 wins to kind of cover up what I said earlier. But at the same time, you can't just punt on a guy who has turned around a 5-win team. You can't necessarily assume that he is plateaued. And I think there are people that are still wondering, what is the upside with Butch Jones? Is he going to be able, like last year was the collection of talent that was supposed to get it done. This year, everybody kind of expects to be a little bit more difficult. They're kind of going under the radar. I just don't know. It's one of those situations where your opinion of Tennessee can change so much from week to week, and it's really been kind of a roller coaster. Even though he has had back to back 9-win seasons, I just don't know what his long term upside is. If he is a guy that can really have you competing on a national level for year in, year out. And I think that's what this year is kind of going to be interesting to see, when expectations are lower and he loses a key member of his coaching staff. How is he going to handle all this? How is he going to replace a quarterback who meant a lot more to that program than maybe we gave him credit for? I just don't know. There's so much unknown with Tennessee right now. It'll be I'm looking forward to having this conversation in 4 or 5 months and seeing how much perspective has changed about him, and we're not just talking about the goofy things he says, and we're not picking apart the tough losses, and we're just looking at the body of work as a whole, because when you're making a head coaching decision, you have to take that all into account. So stay tuned, I guess, is the only real way to say it when it comes to Butch Jones.
All right, last question on the hot topic conversation quickly. It's clearly Sumlin in the West. It's clearly Jones in the East. Give me an underrated hot seat in the SEC, one that might be a little warmer than some fans realize.
Well, I wrote yesterday about how Brett Bielema has a perfect situation to prove himself this year.
He does.
But I think the seat is a little bit hot, and I think there are some people that would sort of call for his job if he were to have a 5-win season, a 6-win season, or something like that, just because he's got a guy back in Austin Allen that could lead the conference in passing again. You've got, you know, good pieces back on defense. You've got an offensive line that's supposed to be significantly better this year, and the schedule is extremely favorable for an SEC West team. So I think Bielema is the guy that's kind of like low-key on the hot seat, but not really. I don't want to put him on the hot seat because I don't think that's necessarily fair given what he's kind of had to work with there. Started off in such a rough situation, obviously not winning an SEC game in his first season there. But he's a guy that if some things go wrong, you know, maybe there's a couple bad stories about him or some ugly national stories, and they finish with 5 wins, I could see him being out of Arkansas. I could definitely see that happening.
Now, Bielema obviously gets a little more rope because he's just a big, lovable teddy bear, and he's a nice figurehead to have at your university, but I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I have a name that's probably going to surprise you and a lot of our listeners. I would not be shocked. Again, I'm not saying he's on the hot seat. I'm not saying he's coaching for his job. Yeah, it's not Nick Saban, of course. Barry Odom, I find his situation very interesting at Mizzou. There's just a lot of things working against this guy. Number one, he's a career assistant. This is his first time getting the top face on the totem pole. He's taking over for a legend in Gary Pinkel, who was there for a long time and took that program to heights that it hadn't seen in quite some time. And not only did he inherit a mess on the field, but that university went through some serious social strife in the last year or two. It's still not entirely done. I know the Ferguson conversation has died down, but it hasn't been swept under the rug entirely. Lots of weird things happening at that school, from the president all the way down to the football locker room. He had a really, really rough year one. He's known as a defensive guy. His defense was unequivocally atrocious. It's hard to look at that roster and say he's going to be better this year. I know they're going to score a good amount of points with Drew Locke throwing the ball and Demarie Crockett running it and Jamon Moore catching it, but is that defense going to be any better? Charles Harris leaves a year early for the NFL, so D-line you, a little lighter than you would like to be. You never want to be the coach who follows the legend. You want to be the next guy, the one who follows the guy who followed the legend. And I wonder if they have another 4-8 type season, there might be some conversations in the show me state that, hey, let's get past the social stuff. Let's get past the Gary Pinkel retirement tour. Maybe look for a bigger name and a better fit for the long term.
4 words for Barry Odom. Don't lose to Purdue.
That would be bad.
That I don't think he'd be low key on the hot seat. I think there'd be a lot of people around there that would be ready to see some changes and some improvements, because it ain't getting any easier in the SEC. And that's a non-conference game you got to win. Mizzou had the embarrassing loss at home a few years back to Indiana, and people in Indiana still are celebrating that to this day. It'd be the same thing if that happened against Purdue. So there are certain moments like that that, okay, you need to be able to assert your dominance against a Power 5 team, and because with the gauntlet SEC schedule, you don't always feel like, okay, hey, we're this competitive Power 5 team, we're able to handle the rigors of this schedule. You beat up on a team like Purdue, and, you know, pretty soon it's, okay, we have the right guys in place here to actually, like, make this work. That's more of a can't-lose game than a must-win game, I would say, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And all right, kids, that is Connor O'Gara. Remember to follow him on Twitter, at CJ O'Gara. You can also follow me, at SaturdayJC. Thank you once again for listening to the Saturday Down South podcast. Special thanks to our friends at WDAE here in Tampa, as well as our sponsor, TicketCity.com. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe to iTunes and give us a rating as well when you get a chance. My name is John Crist, and for All SEC All the Time, visit SaturdayDownSouth.com.